नमस्ते, गुड मॉर्निंग. द इंटरनेट इज अ बिट इरेटिक. देयर इज सम वर्क गोइंग ऑन इन द नेबरहुड, सो इट इज पॉसिबल दैट इट माइट गो डाउन फॉर 5 to 10 minutes. कांट से, सो प्लीज बेयर विद दैट. समवन हैड आस्क्ड मी अ क्वेश्चन ऑन impermanence. Someone who's about 50 years old and who had a very stable life with hardly any dramatic loss or event for a large part of their life. Very secure. More pleasures than pains. Not losing loved ones until a year ago with the loss of her father, her world fell apart. It was her first blow, so to speak. Otherwise, it was a charmed life, extremely wealthy, and so on. And this blow left her completely shattered, not able to recover from it. So one could say that it was perhaps the first taste of impermanence. And therefore, we find that those who have received the blows of life early on, which has set them on this quest, the suffering has kindled a fire. What is life about? They are in a sense fortunate because it kind of makes them see life for what it is. And that is why I keep reiterating Bhagwan Ramana Maharshi's words about coming onto the path. And as he says, if not the first blow, if not the second, by the time one has the third, fourth, or fifth blow, one starts questioning life. I remember when I was perhaps 15 years old, maybe around that time, I had quite a lesson in impermanence. I had to travel very far. I think it was perhaps an hour and a half from my home. I can't recall where I was going, and I know it was for a series of days. I had to go to the same place and in a taxi. Now, this is prior to the internet, prior to Google Maps. And I was timid by nature, so I was pretty nervous about making this trip. And so I devised a plan so that even though the first trip would be a nervous one, I would plot out in my mind all the landmarks I came across to the left and to the right, so that the next day I would be more secure in the knowing that we are on the right track, the cab driver and me. And of course, it would be a different cab driver every morning. And so this journey happened, and the last landmark before which I took a right turn, that gave me tremendous relief because it could not be missed. So I knew that to overshoot that would mean I have missed the turn and I could come back. You see, that is how the mind rationalizes everything. And the landmark was this massive, massive circus tent I remember it said something about a Romanian circus or what, I don't know, huge, which was on the left of the road. And I said, this cannot be missed. And I was relieved. So the next day, I went in quiet confidence. And the obvious happened. The circus was no longer there. Circuses move. And I kept going on ahead and ahead till I realized something was wrong. And so that for me was a big lesson in impermanence. What we rely on, what we hold on to, what we are attached to is something transient and temporary. Living this realization is enlightened living. Our life itself is a circus. Sometimes we laugh, sometimes we cry. We are like the clown, the circus clown. We wear a happy mask to our friends and society, and inside is a world of suffering. Pleasures and pains, that is the circus of our life. As someone shared with me, who's in a new relationship, which is extremely challenging, and he said, whenever we are happy together, I get very tense because I know that in a week to 10 days, something will happen and my girlfriend will be irritated or cheesed off or upset. And then that's another 10 days of pain. Being happy has made him scared because he knows that pain is around the corner. And as Maharaj said, between every two pleasures is a pain. So to be buffeted between pleasure and pain, pleasure and pain, pleasure and pain, can be very tiring. Because what we ordinary humans tend to do is escape the pain. We want to run away from it and hope that life would be only pleasures. Although we know that in our experience, all pleasures are temporary, yet the compulsion to avoid the pain and go to the pleasure, polaric opposite, is what happens. Whereas the man of understanding knows that this is life. Sometimes pleasure, many times pain. He has accepted the duality of life. So there's no running away from anything as far as he is concerned, or she. He faces the pains as they come. Of course, the preference is not to have it. But as they come, they are faced. And he enjoys the pleasures as they come, knowing that they may not come again. And so it is important to know where we stand when it comes to pains in our life. Are we facing the pain, or are we turning our face away from it? This is a good pointer to know where we stand on our spiritual journey. I'll take up some questions now, and then we will open the floor to anyone who would like to share or ask something. I am new to these teachings, and in my quest for understanding the same, I watched your videos. They gave me some peace to my troubled mind. You had said, life is not meant to be understood, it is meant to be lived. These beautiful words have given me strength to start living again. This is a very important point. When we know that we have stopped rationalizing everything that happens to us, then we know that the teaching has sunk in. Whereas earlier we would try making sense of each and every event in our lives, now we accept it as it comes. Then we are not trying to live life anymore through the thinking mind, which is a cause and effect based thinking. A leads to B, leads to C, leads to D, leads to E. That kind of thinking goes out and gets replaced by E had to happen because D had to happen, D had to happen because C had to happen, and C had to happen because B had to happen, and so on and so forth. Which means an acceptance of what is. Understanding the totality, not isolating events, seeing that there is this universal plan behind each event, an engineering, and a very intelligent engineering, which the human mind simply cannot comprehend. Therefore, life is not meant to be understood, but lived. I am very much attached to my father. After his passing away, I feel a big vacuum in my life and feel a strong desire to connect with him. I am married and blessed to have a very loving and caring family, but everything seems to be incomplete without my dad. I miss talking to him and his physical presence very much. I have learned that though the physical body perishes, the soul continues to exist, and that it's a form of energy that's there, and we could remain connected to this through our mind. Could you please share your views on this as per the teachings? As I couldn't find any video on life after death, as to what happens after death, and do we meet our dead loved ones in our next life? Now, this question, what I'm going to focus on is the words here used as per the teachings, because there are many, many speakers, teachers, channels, whatever you may call it, who talk about life after death, connecting with spirits, connecting with souls, etc., etc. But what I would like to focus on is as per the teachings. Now, firstly, for everyone, there are some relationships which are extremely close. A bond which is so strong that when the person passes away, one feels this vacuum intensely. There's no doubt about it. That is how it has been designed. And the hope and wish is to stay connected in some form. Now, death refers to the death of the physical body, the food body. which is what we see on this dimension. What we don't see is the other sheaths, the mind body, the intellect body, the bliss body, because they are not visible to physical eyes. That is one aspect. Now, when it comes to Advaita, you see, what we lose sight of is the fact, and as Joel Goldsmith said this, that when a loved one departs, or anyone for that matter, the physical object, so to speak, has left the scene. But aren't they alive if they are in your consciousness? Aren't they in your consciousness even after the body has perished? Therefore, aren't they close to you? Now, if it is a loved one, you tend to think of them all the time. They are in your consciousness all the time. Could they be any closer? If someone dies in some remote country, you're not even aware of its name, they are not in your consciousness. So what is the content of one's consciousness? Now, for example, my spiritual guide, when he passed away, I must confess that there was grief for a short period. And therefore, I asked myself that, did it mean I didn't love him enough? That was my question. But then I realized that I was thinking of him all the time. Any event which happened during the course of the day, I was seeing in light of the teaching. What would he have said? How would he have seen it? And so it was so close and intimate to me because it was part of the consciousness, you see. Now, what is important is, as this lady has said, that she has a loving and caring family, but this has to be looked at. Are you less available for your loved ones because your mind is stuck as far as your father is concerned? Are you less in the present because of that? After all, there is only one consciousness, the same consciousness functioning through everyone. So while you may miss your father tremendously, like I said, we all have special bonds, is it compromising your daily living? Now, for the sage, that does not happen. For the sage, when the memory arises, grief may arise, a tear may be shed. But there is no thinking in the duration of horizontal time as far as the sage is concerned. It does not mean there is no pain in the moment, you see. But there is no involvement. And the next thing which presents itself for the sage is fully available. There is no cloud, gray cloud, which has veiled the vision of the sage because of the passing away of the loved one. So are we living in the dead past? If we are excessively mourning, the passing away of someone close to us. You see, because we all have limited time here. What's gone is gone. no matter how painful it is. But the little time allocated to us, how we impact the lives of others, what we share with them, do we withdraw from a bit of that because of our loss, my loss? I lost my father. This reminds me of, I spoke about this couple in the city of Pune next to Bombay who lost their son in a tragic accident. And then they started an orphanage. They lost their only son. And they are so happy because they have been able to impact the lives of children without parents. That feeling arose in them, and that's for them what they did. That does not mean they are not missing their son, does not mean grief does not arise, but they moved on, you see. Rather than living a life of darkness and moping and mourning all the time. So coming back to the perspective of the teaching, all there is consciousness. In that sense, your loved ones have not gone anywhere. But because we are so accustomed to a subject-object relationship, we feel that the end of the object is the end of the relationship, whereas all relationships are in consciousness. In that sense, no one can truly die, especially your loved one, because they are in your consciousness all the time. Next one. I have read Nisargadatta Maharaj's I Am That, and while I do enter brief phases of no mind, where all is beautiful and calm, it's mostly the thinking mind which rules my waking hours. I run a small back office, and most of my mind space is taken up by managing its operations. The rest of the time is taken up by my wife, kids, and parents. Despite trying to root myself in the teachings of Advaita, I am disturbed by usual events, such as losing a client, operational issues, staff issues, etc. And it takes a day or two to get over and regain balance. Is this how it should be? What should I aim for? More brief periods of no mind? Please advise. You see, I love this question because this has directly been my experience at work too. And that is why my teacher was very keen. Every Sunday, I would go a bit early and sit with him in his room and recount the events of the week at work. Because as he said, daily living is relationships. And at work, you encounter a wide range of relationships with your clients, suppliers, co-workers, and so on and so forth. Now, the point here is, what results with this teaching being imbibed is that the thinking mind quietens down. It is not about the no mind state. If one is working, one needs the faculties. The working mind has to be fully operational. Now, if there's a staff issue, let's say the loss of a client, let's approach this very practically, most pragmatic way of seeing things. Pain will arise, especially if you are dependent on that client. Your income depends on that client. Pain will arise for the sage as well. And the sage will also wonder, now what do I do? What expenses do I cut down? You see? But the sage knows that the loss of the client is the will of God. The sage does not agonize over the loss of the client. He may introspect. He may ask himself whether he and his team did not meet the client's expectations where they should have. This is all part of the working mind. But the overriding dynamic here is that the loss of the client happened because it had to happen, whether or not they gave their best. Now that acceptance cuts off the involvement. So if the ordinary person has been, not able to sleep for 4 or 5 days because of this event, the sage will not lose that kind of sleep, you see. The sage accepts the will of God. It does not mean that the minute the client calls him and says bye-bye, he's in samadhi and peace. That's not going to happen. He's working. Similarly, he gets a new client. Pleasure will arise, but he will not be elated and overjoyed because the sage knows clients come and clients go. Staff issues. Let's say your manager, a very important staff member, resigns overnight. You're rattled. Has he or she given sufficient notice? How will I train the new member? Part of the process. But once again, the sage knows that this relationship was destined to come to an end now, and that has happened. So there is no blame and finger pointing and judging. Supposing the staff member says, oh, I was offered 5,000 rupees more per month. And you start thinking, oh, this person has been with me for so many years. How dare he or she do this? Look at people, how they are, blah, blah, blah. All that is finished as far as the sage is concerned. Why? Because life is not meant to be understood, but to be lived. The sage accepts that no matter what, no matter the number of years given by the staff member, etc., 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 the time came for this relationship to end. This acceptance of the flow of life is what gives the sage peace of mind. And the resistance is what troubles the ordinary person. And it is true that what you resist persists. And so by and by, you find that the thinking mind is less involved and one is more present to what is. And therefore, one can slip more easily into no mind. Because when the mind is not excessively engaged in thinking and is resting in what is, what happens? When there is something to witness, it is witnessed. And when there's nothing to witness, one slips into the non-witnessing state. Because the mind is no longer looking for the next happening. Whereas the ordinary mind is looking out, what next, what next? Where can I get hooked on to? Where can I get attached to? There's the quiet mind, where the thinking mind is no longer operating, is a resting mind. Available for what is, and when there is no immediate event in what is, it is resting in non-witnessing. When there is an event, the non-witnessing becomes witnessing. And therefore, because of that, the involvement in what is witnessed is shrinking. the knee-jerk reactions, for example, take place less and less. So the next time a staff member resigns overnight, momentary pain may arise. But because one is disengaged, so to speak, there's such little involvement in the happening. You see, that is the measure. How involved are we in what happens in our lives? On one level, the sage is fully involved, in the sense, fully available for the happening. All the faculties are wide open. But in terms of the psychological mind, the thinking mind, no involvement. The concept of avatars is puzzling. Whether known general or against Nisargadatta Maharaj's teachings, what is your feeler in light of its ratiocinations, or whether Maharaj or Rameshji's anywhere spoken about it? Avatars come down yuga after yuga is axiomatic, but who gets them aboard is quixotic. Are they coming down owing to the effect of several minds' overwhelming prayers, or of their own accord? You made it very clear in your book, The Buddha's Sword, that God or the cosmic power cannot be understood owing to a larger picture. But then this avatar rationale is an issue for me to reckon with. You see, I generally don't take on these kind of questions because they really have no connection with daily living and peace of mind, which is what I speak about. Not that the question is invalid. It's not about that. The question is valid. All questions are valid. Because all questions come from the same source eventually. But consciousness sends down avatars when consciousness feels the need is there. There is no individual avatar who decides to descend down when he sees trouble happening on planet Earth. And if there's collective mind praying and hoping for an avatar, even that is a movement in consciousness. Everything is a play of consciousness, in consciousness, by consciousness. Now, Vishnu had 10 incarnations, 9 of which have happened. Vishnu as the sustaining power, the all-pervader of the universe, one of the Holy Trinity in Hinduism, of the creator, sustainer, and destroyer, manifested across eras as one form of avatar or the other. The most famous being Krishna, Ram, and the Buddha. So it is not an individual called the Buddha or Krishna who decided that I am going to come down because I have seen that the world needs me. So that is the brief answer to this question. I'll take this last one and then we can open the floor up. I'm a bit confused about the teaching, especially the topic of no effort. Is it egoic to desire excellence and pursue goals and ambitions? For example, I desire to earn more money because I'm in a poor financial situation and I want to provide basic comforts to my family. How do I do that without putting effort? If I don't put effort now, how will I achieve my goals? The teaching talks about non-doership and says that the outcome is not in our control. So does that mean we become passive and let things be the way they are? Can you please help clear my confusion? Now, this is a very basic question which comes up all the time, but I still feel it has to be addressed. This teaching is not about no effort. You see, this is what happens, that people mistake this teaching for being a teaching of no effort. If anyone says there's no sadhana, there's no effort required, I'd be wary of that. Even Ramana Maharshi's self-inquiry, who am I? You need effort. You need to put in the effort and ask yourself, who am I? When anything happens, any thought arises, whom is this thought happening to? That is the sadhana. That is the effort. What this teaching points to is to understand that the so-called effort is not your effort. You have been gifted by attributes, the five senses, six senses. You have been gifted by a set of circumstances, your genetics, your conditioning, your geographical environment, your economic environment, which were none of your doing. And therefore, effort is effort. This is what the Gita is about. But it is not my effort. This is what it is pointing to. And what happens with this understanding? If I meet with failure, in spite of putting my best efforts, since now I know it is not my effort, it is not my failure. Once again, that is what the Gita is about. You cannot control the result of your actions. So this ego which steps in and claims ownership and possession of my effort, my success, and my failure, that is annihilated. When success happens, pleasure arises. But now that I know it is not my effort, but this vast set of circumstances that was presented before me, which resulted in success, what happens? Pleasure arises, but there's no pride and arrogance, because it is not my success based on my effort. It is success based on factors which God made. It is failure based on factors which God made. I certainly didn't make them. So make no mistake. Obviously, if you have financial goals, you have to put in the effort. You're not going to be sitting back and assuming things will happen. They could happen to someone whose destiny is not to work, and yet he or she wins a lottery ticket. Their destiny. But if you feel the need to make an effort, by all means make it. Knowing that it is not your effort in that sense. It does not mean there's no effort. But with failure, you will not feel guilty with this understanding. You will not hate yourself with this understanding. You will not hate God with this understanding, blaming Him for your failure. Ultimately, success and failure is a movement in consciousness, which we have put a label on, one label called success, one label called failure. In the larger picture, it may not be success and it may not be failure. But for the me, it is success, and from the me, it is failure. Often we have heard of stories of how people have had many failures in life, which have been stepping stones to a future success. So is it a failure? And therefore, outcomes are not really judged as success or failure by the sage. Nisargadatta Maharaj said, abide in your being. Even that requires effort. Just try it and you'll find that your thinking mind is all over the place. It does not mean Nisargadatta Maharaj meant no effort, just abide in your being. It's so easy. Try it. It exposes the thinking mind. It exposes the monkey mind. In some context, masters say no effort. Everything is in context, you see, but we tend to latch on to these things and make them the whole and sole. That is why Ramana Maharshi would say that when you're working, yes, let the thought arise. It is not me doing the work, but the current that is doing the work through me, which is consciousness. That is why Aurobindo would say, to acknowledge the divine, when you begin your work, when you end it, and if you can, remember it every now and then during the course of your work. This is the true meaning of work, is worship. This is why Aurobindo would say that just meditating is not enough. That is dealing with the inner world, but you are engaging in the outer world. How are you at work? That is also meditation. It's not a practice of an hour. It's daily living. If one is witnessing whatever arises during the course of the day as movements in consciousness, one is meditating with eyes open. If anyone would like to ask something, they are welcome to now. Yes, Ramanathan.
Thanks, Gautamji. Are you able to hear me?
Yes.
Gautamji, actually, I came with a lot of questions, but I'm sure everyone would be feeling that. This is the most enlightening satsang that probably you have attended. All the questions actually were answered. I don't know how to express my gratitude to you. Right? It was so beautiful, because the question that was running in my mind was, in all the conversations that I've satsang that I've attended, it was always the emphasis on the will of God. Events happen, deeds happen. There is no sense of doership. Right? That's been from your teachings, from Ramesh-ji's teachings, from your book, Buddha's What. That's actually what I meant. But nowhere you actually, in the sense, satsang spoke about karmas. Prarabdha, Sanchita, Agami, karmas you spoke. So when I logged in for the satsang, I was trying to reconcile these two, that you have never used the word karma in your conversation. You have always used the will of God. And I wanted to ask you that question, but I think you answered it. The question melted away here, I would say.
Good. Maybe I should do one talk with just the word karma. That would balance the scales.
Thank you, Gautamji. I want to share something, if you don't mind.
Sure.
In a couple of satsangs back, I was mentioning that I've reached 45 and I wanted to quit everything. I want to take Vanaprastha. That doesn't mean I quit everything, active life, and go into a forest. That's not the point. I wanted to go by what JK used to say, that actively pursue the truth. Right? I spoke to you about that, and strange to say, that actually an idea sprouted, and we went for a startup last week. We registered the company instead of taking Vanaprastha.
The polaric opposite happened.
And I got the company on puja days. The company got registered as a startup, and we registered a domain actually.
Uh-huh.
I'm taking your blessings to be engaged, but as you rightly said, not to take it as my effort, but as the will
yes.
of God.
Yes, all the best. Be engaged totally, not just be engaged. Be engaged totally.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, all the best for that. Yes, Lifen.
Namaste, Gautam.
First
of all, I would like to thank you for your time and your service and your compassion and your teaching. I have a question regarding this concept about free will. Actually, regarding the non-doership, I understand it, and I have also myself personal experience about what it's talking about, like what is the non-doership, what this witnessing is just things just happens as it happens. That part I really understand. There's no problem about it. But recently, I came to contact with this concept or this idea or this, this concept about free will. And I was like, I don't get it. Like, since everything just happens as it happens, how come people talk about we need to like use our free will? Like, where is this free will coming from? Like, whose free will would it be? And then I discuss it with my friends, spiritual friends, and they say, well, think about this. Like, if you are keep maturing and growing in your spiritual practice, you are letting go of a lot of compulsive behavior. And then you are more in tune with your natural mind. And out of this natural mind, free wills, this is what I understand, free wills arises. So right now, my understanding is free will is like when you become more free of your attachment and of all this, what is the word? I forgot. Samsara? Like when you are more detached and when you are more free, and then you will be able to use the free will. So I would like to know, I would like to ask you for your comments about what is your take on free will? What is free will?
Yeah. Okay. You see, let's take a very different route or route, as you say, to understand this concept of free will from what you have perhaps thought about and shared with your friends and they have shared with you. We are operating in the realm of duality, where everything has its polaric opposite. Left and right, up and down, front and back, healthy children and handicapped children, pleasure and pain, and so on and so forth. This is the structure of duality. And now we have free will and God's will. You see, now there's a very important point here. The human being tends to believe that it has free will and therefore is responsible for its decisions. And what this teaching does, it says, wait a minute, just wait a minute. Let's just look at free will. You don't control your breaths. That's the first thing. The blood coursing through your veins, you don't control. You don't control where you were born, the parents you were born to, the geographical environment, the religion you were born into, and the conditioning you received from day one. On the basis of all this, Lifen takes decisions in life and thinks, I have free will and I am going to decide this or this. What this teaching is doing is saying, hey, wait a minute. If all that your so-called free will is based on is not in your control, is it truly your free will? And if it is not your free will, whose free will is it? Think about that. Look at that. You see? So when Lifen realizes, my God, actually it's true. It appears that I can take decisions and I'm choosing one thing over the other. Is that really my choice? Or is that choice dependent on so many factors which make me who I am? And then Lifen realizes that actually, while free will and exercising free will is the mechanism of daily living without which I can't function, I have to decide about things. That value which I assigned to free will is actually worthless because it is not my free will. Now what happens with this understanding? Lifen's grip on his free will starts getting released. All that accountability which Lifen had for himself, if he beat himself up on a wrong decision which led to a consequence which was not good and so on and so forth, that starts lightening up. And Lifen realizes, in the larger scheme of things, my decision was just one aspect which led to a happening, but it was truly not my decision. Now, this does not mean that because Lifen has understood all this, he has even more free will. This means Lifen's will is now aligned to God's will. Lifen now lives with the knowing that what is my will is truly God's will. And so, daily living starts becoming lighter and lighter and lighter because the grip of I am in control because of my free will, that starts going away because the truth has been seen. The truth has been seen that in the world of duality, in this world which has opposites, within which I live my life, I am no longer in its grip now. So if I do something, I now know that truly I am not the doer. So free will and doership is absolutely linked. They are not two separate aspects. If I am not the doer, God is the primal doer. So these cannot be looked at separately. To understand one is to understand both. It's very important. And I'm so glad you raised this point. Because if one has the understanding that one is not the doer of one's actions, it is but obvious that God is the only doer, and I have accepted that. So if I have a friend who upsets me and says something I don't like, but I have the immediate unconditional knowing and acceptance that he is an instrument of God, just as I am. He said what he said based on his genetics and condition, just like I say, I no longer judge my friend. Why? Because he's not the doer. So I may not like what he said, and I may tell him that, because after all, I'm living my daily life. But I no longer blame and condemn him. So can you see how closely the concept of non-doership and free will is related? Because if I know he's not the doer, it means he doesn't have any such free will to exercise. He's expressing what God is expressing through him. And it so happens I don't like it. Because of the way I am conditioned, if I was conditioned differently, I may have had no problem with what he said. So these are very closely interrelated. And to understand one is to understand both. To understand only one means even that one has not been understood in totality.
What is the one and what is the other one? You mean to understand both, but which, what
God's
is the
will and non-doership, free will and non-doership.
Okay.
They are aspects of the same coin. They are two sides of the same coin.
Okay. What is free will for you again? I'm sorry. Like, there's no free will, right?
What is free will for me?
Yeah. Well, how do you define free will? What is a free will?
Just take any event which you are going to encounter in the course of the day. Let's say you want to meet someone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And you feel that based on my free will, I am going to pick up the phone, call this person up and meet. That is living what I think is my free will. But when I know that the thought of my friend arose in my mind on its own, it reminded me of him or her, and it makes me pick up the phone and call, he or she may or may not be available for the meeting. I know that it's really not my free will which has triggered this whole event and made me call this person. I know that the thought came from where I don't know. Out of 100 friends, I thought of this friend. I took action on it, but whether my friend is available or not is God's will. So I know that this so-called effort of picking up the phone, etc., is truly not my will. Because mm-hmm. the first cause was not mine, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So that is what I mean by free will. So when you start living your life knowing that it is not your free will in that sense you've been exercising all along, it is just an aspect of the event or the happening, you become more and more relaxed.
Okay, now I understand. But let me suppose a case. At this moment, I can choose to be in the present, right? Or I can choose to just chase my random thoughts. So is there any freedom in it that I decide, no, I want to be in this present. I want to, or let's say, I want to choose to let go of everything and just be. Is this a free will, or even this decision is based on my previous conditions? So even I decided to, okay, I'm just going to let go everything and I'm just going to, yeah. Is this a decision, or is this also not a decision? It's just because of my previous condition.
Supposing you were carrying a load of 10 bricks, a heavy load of 10 bricks, and you really got tired and you decided to put the 10 bricks down. Is that your free will, or is it the load of the 10 bricks which made you get tired and therefore made you put the bricks down?
That's because I was in my like breaking point, like I reached the threshold of I cannot carry anymore, right? Mm-hmm. So that's based on previous condition. But how about if I say I want to be awakened and I choose to let go of my conditioning, like I don't know what is my conditioning, doesn't matter. I choose to totally abide in the self, even though I may not be able to do it in the, like, maybe the next moment I will just like go to play video games, let's say. But at this moment, I choose to be aligned with myself. Is this choosing also not a free will? Or there is a free will in choosing this?
There is no free will in choosing it, though it appears there is free will in choosing it. Because you reached a point, and that point was not determined by you.
Okay, so there's no way I will not choose to abide by myself at that moment. I must, well, the fact is I choose to abide.
You try. The results are not in your control. So the choosing becomes a mechanism of daily living, but now life knows that truly there is no chooser here. You see, that is what happens. Life now knows that choices have to be made, okay? But there is truly no chooser. There's this whole aspect which life has no control over, which makes the choice.
Yeah, I think I got what you say. You say choice will be made, but there's no one who chooses it, right?
Yes.
Oh, okay. So now I understand there's no conflict between the free will that the concept of free will that I have come in contact, and the concept of non-doership. Right now, that free will, what that concept is talking about, is just I don't know how to describe it, but it seems to me that this free will is more as like abiding by the self. It just happened naturally. I don't know.
Yes, that's true. That is well said. It happens naturally. But if you find in your dialogue that, you know, words like I choose my free will, you'll find that that dialogue itself changes. You see, because this grip of me and my free will, my choice, my decision, that kind of loosens up.
Yes, yes. But there's also another factor which in, let's say, in a Buddhist tradition, they say you arise a compassionate wish or volition to awaken or to help the sentient beings, let's say, like this strong force, this strong wish, or this strong, I don't know, like volition.
Yes, no, that's the difference, Lifen. The strong wish and the compassion arises because one has seen things for as they are. Compassion is the felt oneness with being. It arises. There is no volition in it. Volition is of the me. I want to be compassionate. Whereas compassion, true compassion, is the absence of the me. And the nature of this arising, as you say, this compassion, is to be available for others, to embrace consciousness, embracing itself. The me is not in the picture. If the me is in the picture, saying, I want to be compassionate as a result of what has happened, then the ego has come in through the back door.
Got you. So there is no need for this ego to even accelerate the process of dissolving. So the ego has no use in the process of dissolving itself. Even a positive ego is not, it's not necessary, and it does, it's not, it doesn't make it faster or better or anything.
It certainly doesn't.
Okay.
It certainly doesn't.
Okay.
Very beautifully put, Lifen. I'm glad you asked these questions.
Thank you.
It's like, on a different note, as Joel Goldsmith would say, you know, if, let's say, if someone is giving a donation or charity to some poor institution or poor man, if the understanding is that I am not giving this donation of my volition, but money which came to me as a result of God, therefore God's money is going to God. You see, it's not I am giving a donation. It is not I am doing charity. God's money which came to this instrument is going to that instrument. So if we are doing charity and giving donations with that understanding that it is not mine, that is enlightened living.
Okay. Now I understand. Okay. That seems like very natural and relaxed, just as you say, very natural and relaxed. And there's no effort in it. It just happens, right? Naturally. So.
100%.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Gautam.
Yes, sir, Ramanathan, you want to clarify something else?
Actually, it's not to, just to contribute to the beautiful discussion between Mr. Lifen and you. Thanks. It was a wonderful conversation. I suddenly, this point came up to me, which I have learned from Ganeshan. So Ganeshan uncle, who is a grandnephew of Bhagwan. In one of his conversations, he explains self. He actually says that self is like a wall. On that wall, if you draw a circle, and the self is looking through that form. So that form is what this form is, right? Whereas the self is the wall. And the self is looking through this wall, the circle. And the circle is assuming its own independent existence.
Yeah.
That's the assumption that I am the chooser. Whereas actually it is the self that is functioning through the circle. But the circle is assuming its own existence, independent of the wall.
Amazing, isn't it? And even in doing that, it has no choice. That is how the ego is designed.
Exactly. So we don't question the assumption that it is looking through this circle, this form.
Correct. Consciousness is very naughty, right? It just tries to trouble us.
To answer, that beautiful point that you and Mr. Liffen was having, actually, that you actually talked about the assumption that there is a chooser. you hit the root of that point. It just reminded me of what Ganesh and Mama were sharing.
Yeah, and that's what creates the suffering, you know. The assumption that there's a chooser creates the suffering.
Right. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. We'll just sit for a couple of minutes in silence. I'll just change the view here.